One.
For 4 decades, the countries of Eastern Europe were trapped behind the Iron Curtain, attracting only a few travelers from the West. Our guest today in this edition of One on One is the American writer, scholar and photographer Ruth Ellen Gruber, whose reporting career brought her to the communist bloc in the 1970s. She spent time in Belgrade and Warsaw, among other places, and after the fall of communism, she stayed in Europe and became a leading scholar on Eastern European Jewish heritage and the region's country music. Ruth, how do these two interests come together?
These interests come together in a sort of funny way. One of the processes and one of the things that I've been quite interested in and have explored quite a bit in the Jewish sphere is the way that non-Jewish people in Europe, in places where very few, if any, Jews live today, become interested in, appropriate, or use Jewish culture, Jewish traditions for their own purposes, either to form their own identities or out of interest. And I also became interested then in how Europeans are fascinated by the American Wild West and all its trappings, and sort of feel at home in that mythology, and often use that mythology to sort of inform their own culture. And part of this is country music.
One of your books is entitled Virtually Jewish. What does the term mean?
It stems from the concept that there's a Jewish space in Europe. This is a concept that was sort of brought out by a scholar called Diana Pinto in the 1990s, that there's a Jewish space in Europe that will remain there and be filled even if no Jews live there at all. So it's also sort of like the image of the Jew that continues to haunt post-Holocaust, post-communist Europe. And I was interested in how this Jewish space is filled. And since there are very few Jews here, the Jewish space is often filled by non-Jews in their activities, non-Jewish klezmer bands, Jewish culture festivals that are run by and for non-Jews, and Jewish museums that are set up by non-Jews, all of this type of thing.
You have seen most Jewish heritage sites around the former Soviet bloc. Under communism, most of them were not very well kept and, in fact, left to dilapidate. Are there any differences when you look at the various countries in terms of what they have been doing with the Jewish heritage since the fall of communism?
Yeah, very much so. It varies from country to country, place to place. And the country, I guess, that's been the most dramatically positive in developments has been here in the Czech Republic, where a strategy of dealing with Jewish heritage sites, synagogues, cemeteries, etc., was developed quite early on in the 1990s. And one by one, synagogues in the outlying provinces have been restored. They're sometimes converted to Jewish museums. They're promoted for tourism, and there's been a partnership between the Jewish community, local authorities, sometimes national authorities, and international organizations. In some countries, almost nothing has been done. And in other countries, it's a mixed bag. So there is a dramatically different mindset in many places regarding Jewish heritage sites. People don't ask so much, you know, why restore them anymore. They ask, you know, what to do with them, how to restore them. And in many places now, these sites finally are considered part and parcel of local heritage and national heritage. They're European. They're not a separate Jewish thing the way they once were considered.
Well, apart from all the Jewish heritage sites you've seen, you've also visited many country music festivals in this part of the world. How does country music stand compared to the original country music, that is the American style of country music?
A lot of the country music in Europe is, you know, imitative of the American. And there are a lot of fans and a lot of experts in Europe who will only listen to American country music. They reject any sort of local production. But what's interesting to me is the way that local societies, particularly in Czech Republic and in Germany, and also elsewhere, but in these two countries have sort of developed their own country music. I mean, here you make the distinction between Czech country, that is country music sung in Czech for a Czech audience. This was imposed under communism that to perform publicly, you had to perform in Czech. And the early bands who took English names, like the Greenhorns and Rangers in the 60s, had to change their names even to Czech names. The government mandated this. So there was a real Czech genre created of Czech country, and especially bluegrass has become very, very popular here. And yes, there's the American aspect to it, but there's also a type of the music that is very local, and that I find fascinating.
I remember my parents had an album by one of the most famous Czech country musicians, Michal Tučný, and he recorded that album with American singer Rattlesnake Annie in Czechoslovakia in the early 1980s. Why would an American country music singer come to a communist country back then?
I think Rattlesnake Annie, you know, she came here on invitation, and she and Michal Tučný just simply clicked. And they performed together. They got along very well. And she began a career over here. She was recognized. She toured not just Czechoslovakia as it was, but she also played in East Germany, and she played in West Germany. She played with a lot of European country acts. And she wasn't the first, but she was one of several American artists who made their careers in Europe. The most famous or infamous was Dean Reed, who sang a sort of rockabilly, rock country songs, and also appeared in the sort of East German Wild West films. But Rattlesnake Annie was unusual in that she did this in communist bloc. And the year before last, which would have been the 60th birthday of Tučný, the Country Fontana Festival was held to honor that date, and Rattlesnake Annie came back and sang the duets that she used to sing with Michal Tučný. She sang them with contemporary Czech artists like Petr Kocman and others. And it was a very moving moment. The crowd just, you know, went wild.
You helped translate several songs into English by the bluegrass band Druhá Tráva. They regularly tour the U.S. How are they received over there?
They have a following in the United States. They're known, and they usually, since 1994... until the year before last, they were touring every summer as long as 2 months at a time, as long as, you know, 40 gigs all across the country. And they have been profiled in the media, appeared on National Public Radio and other places like that. And it was interesting. I was able to catch their concert near Los Angeles in 2007, in the fall. And I was astonished to hear that. I wanted to really to hear how they performed in front of an English-speaking American audience. And, the main difference was that they sang more songs in English and fewer songs in Czech, but they sang songs in Czech. And the audience, you know, just ate it up. It was really, really a rapt audience. And what was also very interesting was at the end of the show, the owner of the coffee house did not let them get off stage because he wanted to know how come there's a bluegrass band and bluegrass in Czech Republic. How did you get interested in it? What is this all about? Because even that coffee house owner who had hired them and booked them and loved them, and there were people in the audience who had seen them over and over again whenever they were in the area, even he couldn't figure it out. You know, it was such a strange thing for him. So, you know, they had to stand on stage and sort of answer these questions. And it was really a scene. It was really, really interesting. Really, you know, sort of wacky.